Jeff went on to design the hardware that NASA is using right now to listen to voices in space.
See, it's such a shame we're losing all these roadies to these bullshit careers.
And I was in a health club getting a regular massage, none of that shifty stuff. And
we ran I don't know what you mean. Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon and paperback Kindle or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. David Dansky has been a sound designer, mixer, production, and or tour manager for Julio Iglesias, Engelbert Humperdinck, Bette Midler, Cher, Itzhak Perlman, Dionne Warwick, Natalie Cole, Sharo, The Manhattan Transfer, Sergio Mendes, George Benson, Joel Grey, Debbie Reynolds, the original Fifth Dimension, Bobby Vinton, Florence Henderson, that's got to be fun, Jim Nabors, got to be fun, Donna Summer, Neil Sedaka, the Isley Brothers, Tina Marie, Doc Severinsen, Yoshiki, I thought that was interesting, I had to read up on that guy, Barbara Streisand, and even Frank Sinatra. Jan Landy is my second guest. He's also a sound guy. He's worked with Sly and the Family Stone, the Doobie Brothers, and even a little band called Led Zeppelin. He's the host of Sound Broker's Mastermind Roundtable. And to spice things up a bit, he's worked as a stand-up comedian. So my first question is, are you as funny when you're sitting down, or do you have to be a stand-up comedian?
That's a line right out of David's wife's mouth. She said, I'm a lot funnier when I'm sitting down.
Oh, yeah.
She said, you should be a sit-down comedian.
I watched one of your stand-up routines there. Was it Jan like the month, Land like the realty, or was it?
Yeah, it was January, you know, Jan like in January, and Landy like in real estate with a Y. But I did not perform under that name. I performed under an alias, which will still be an alias.
Oh, all right.
Disclosed alias at the time.
Fair enough.
Now, it's an interesting thing how you change names over a period of time and how people know you from a particular name. So a long, long, long time ago, when I first moved to Hollywood, I got the nickname of Cash. And we can go into that story because it's kind of clever. It's a clever story. So I there was Dangerous Deborah in the room, Big John, my friend Michael. And basically, I had lent Deborah some money. And she said to me, Jan, I've got that $25. I forgot to get to the bank, but could I write you a check? And I said, yeah, make it out to Cash. And she actually wrote it out to Cash Landy. Everybody laughed. And from that moment in time, those people in the room started calling me Cash, right? So I went to the bank to cash the check, and they wouldn't cash it because my name wasn't Cash Landy. So I had read an article about it in a paper about you could change your name as long as it's not for illegal purposes. So I changed my middle name to Cash so I could cash that check.
You legally changed your name for that?
Yeah, legally.
How much was the check?
It's so simple. You just go down to DMV. All you have to do is go to DMV and apply for a name change. That's it. Simple as can
be. What was your old middle name?
That will remain anonymous. No.
Oh, it's a winner, huh?
Yeah, no. It's a normal name. I mean, a lot of people have that, but I prefer not to give that out at this point. You know, just let's leave it at that. Now my name, now I know you, now I use no middle name at all. On my passport, it just says Jan Landy. And, but you know, so when I see people who know me for a long time, they'll call me Cash. And then people think they're clever and want to call me Cash and I don't know them, I don't really appreciate it, you know? I never let girls call me Cash either, because when it would be in bed and they would say, oh, Cash, it was a bad connotation to me. So I always said, call me Jan.
Okay, you got rules. How much was the check for?
The check was for $25.
That's not even a lot. How much did it cost to change your name?
Nothing free. Go to DMV in those days. It was free. I guess, you know, it worked out. It worked out. And it was a good career. Even my company now, the official name of the company is Cash Landy Pro Sales Incorporated.
Oh, okay.
Just a little correction. David is the consummate sound man. I am a production manager. That's what I did. Although I have mixed sound, my first band that I ever mixed sound for that, you know, just was a freak of accident was the Doobie Brothers back in like 1970 in the Ventura Theater. And the only reason I got that job, the only reason, because I was going, I had just got out of the military and I was up in Santa Barbara because that's where my cousins were. And I'd got a job. So seeing I was a medic in the military, I'd gotten a job at the free clinic. And the singer of this band comes in and he has, he had some sort of, I believe it was gonorrhea, actually. Ooh. And so I gave him a shot. It was crazy about that. But he said, hey, I'm playing in the park right next door to the clinic. Why don't you come? And while I was at the park, I met the guy that ran the sound company, a guy by the name of Jeff Cook. And Jeff Cook had a company called Soundstorm Systems. And he was saying, hey, we're doing the Doobie Brothers tomorrow, when he found out that I had a car. And so he says, hey, if, you know, we could use your car. It was one of those old Volkswagen squarebacks. Oh, and sure. So I said, sure. So I loaded his equipment into my car with his truck. And we all went down to, and the sound engineer didn't show up for the Doobie Brothers. So he turns to me and he says, hey, you want to mix the sound? I said, sure. What do I got to do? He says, just turn these knobs. That was it.
So you're an East Coast guy originally, right?
I am an East Coast guy. Yes, that's true.
So you just came to Santa Barbara to hang out with the family, and it's a nice place to live.
No. Is that where you used to live, Santa Barbara?
I did, actually. Yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful up there. You know, used to go to Devereaux, and we used to hang out at the cemetery before they closed that off. You know, because it had such a beautiful vista over the hills where everybody would go to get high or, you know, get laid, whatever. You know. Devereaux, of course, was the nude beach right there. And, you know, it was cool. When I got there, you could still walk on the beach without getting tar on your feet.
Yeah. So then I had the tar. I was tar days.
Yeah. By the time, you know, I guess my second year in, you couldn't even walk on the beach anymore because they had that oil spill. And that was a shame, unfortunately.
By the way, Jeff Cook, the guy who owned the sound company, it's not just a guy. He's one of the people who helped design the Wall of Sound for the Grateful Dead.
Oh.
So he's like a major player who just happened to be in Santa Barbara. So
you were in Santa Barbara too, David, at one point?
No. I've only even worked there once or twice in all these years I've been doing it.
Oh.
At that majestic, yes, whatever that theater is called, the old theater.
Santa Barbara Bowl?
Indoor. There's an old, like, it's an old theater with the inside. It's got real nice decorations inside. 1930s.
There's the Ventura Theater, like Jan said. I don't know.
Yeah, that was where it was. It was the Ventura Theater.
I can look it up.
Yeah.
I could tell you a quick interesting story about Jeff. Jeff actually, you know, many years later, first of all, to go back to the Wall of Sound, he came up with the idea of the 4-inch neodymium drivers, and they built the whole wall. That's what it was, all those 4-inch neodymium drivers. But Jeff went on to design the hardware that NASA is using right now to listen to voices in space.
See, it's such a shame we're losing all these roadies to these bullshit careers.
Now he's sailing around the world. The last I heard, he was sailing around. He built a sailboat and he was sailing around the world.
That's awesome.
One thing that connected David and I through Jeff was Jeff needed to buy some equipment. And so we went down to Spectrasonics in Hollywood. It was my first trip in Hollywood. And we went to this tall skyscraper at the top. And at that time, there was a man by the name of Al Siniscal. Al Siniscal went on to own A1 Audio. And that is my connection with David.
Oh,
that's where it came in. David was the one who brought me into A1, but I met Al in the old days through Jeff Cook. So I knew Al before David knew Al, but yep. David was the one who introduced me, and we all became friends at that point. And that's when I got involved with A1 Audio many years later as their vice president of marketing.
Did you guys do any Grateful Dead stuff, either one of you?
I first of all, I just wanted to say Al Senescal is one of the first Parnelli Award winners as a mover and shaker in the business for basically inventing bi-amplifying, tri-amplifying, and that. He's that smart, and the company was that cool. But I never worked with the Grateful Dead, but I ended up becoming friends with the Allman Brothers crew because my first band opened for them once, and I just hit it off because those guys were great, and the band was, you know, unbelievable band to watch. And when they played with the Dead at RFK Stadium, I was able to stand behind the sound mixers and listen to the show. And so the wall of sound was up, and I got to experience the wall of sound.
Neat.
So even though I did not work with the Dead, I definitely had an experience with them.
Yeah, that's neat. So where are you from originally, David?
New York. Born in the Bronx, raised in White Plains. Then I moved to Manhattan after college and stayed there for 5 years. And my first band, my first entry into the business was in New York City with a band that exploded in New York in the East Coast called Mandrill back in 1970.
Sure.
They were one of the first bands to record at Electric Lady Studios. When Jimi Hendrix died, they were the first ones who were in there. And my first gig was a sound mixer for them. And they were huge, including headlining stadiums in the East Coast. So I got really lucky. And
so you started working for them, and then you kept taking gigs.
Well, I worked for them for 5 years, and I had always wanted to move to California ever since the Summer of Love. I said, that's it, but I can't. I'm in college. I got to finish and all that. And then I was doing sound for 5 years, and the band finally moved to LA. So I came out here with a job, and that was it. I haven't left.
Wow. Now, David has got an interesting story because of his college education, what David went to school for. And to me, David's first job while in school, to me, is the most fascinating job of all.
Well, newsman? Flying to Chicago every day?
Yes.
You flew to Chicago every day?
It never happened, but in the pilot stage, there was going to be, before you landed in every city in the United States, certainly every major city, there was a radio receiver in the plane that my company put in, and the flight attendants would activate before you landed, and a news broadcast would come on, a 5-minute news broadcast of national, state, local traffic, because it was up to the hour. And the pilot program was New York, Chicago. So my job every day was to get on a plane in LaGuardia Airport and fly to Chicago, spend the afternoon there talking to the flight attendants. What a tough gig. And yeah, I was actually allowed in the bay, in the electronics bay of the plane, if I had to exchange a receiver, and then fly home.
So did you marry a flight attendant?
No, I didn't. But I didn't get married for a lot
Full
of years.
Teacher.
I still had my road life to experience before I settled down. But it was a great start. I graduated college with an electrical engineering degree.
Okay.
And I was one of the first guys in the industry to have a degree. So when it came time to learn audio, are you going to be a sound guy? Yeah, I'm an engineer. I'll be a sound guy. Oh, what's a balanced line? Oh, that's what a balanced line is. That's what an electret microphone is. So I learned all of these things, but I picked them up instantly because I understood the concepts. So I got up to speed. I ramped up really quickly into being a front of house mixer and monitor mixer too, because we did both at the same time. And when I would travel, the band didn't really tour as much as go out and do shows. So I used the sound company locally, and I got to meet all the owners of all the sound companies and tell them what I've seen in other parts of the country. So I was kind of cross pollinator. They all liked me to come around. I was fun to hang out with because of all the stories I could tell them about their.
Is he still fun to hang out with, Jan?
Oh, he's a ton of fun to hang out with. You know, David and I always have a great time. But I just want to give a little quick aside to the audience that is, you know, thinks that the only thing that they have is cable news now. When David was doing this, there was no cable news. You know, no cable news. The cable news was a newspaper. That's what you had, a newspaper. That's it.
We had teletype machines with UPI, API, and Reuters, which were the only way you got your news. Certainly your international news. And every hour, the guy would do two broadcasts, one for Chicago and one for New York. So I did that, and then it was working so well that they put me in the shop, and I was doing electronic stuff in the shop, but I really couldn't relate to those people. They were all saying, why are you guys against the war in Vietnam? Why don't you trust the government? Why do you like your music lab? Why do you wear long hair? Why? And I'm going, why am I in this business? And so when the company went out of business, the money died, the head guy died. I started collecting unemployment saying, okay, what am I going to do? I don't want to hate my life. And I was in a health club getting a regular massage, none of that shifty stuff. And we ran into a guy who was working for the guy who put the Beatles in Shea Stadium, Sid Bernstein.
Sure.
And he was an impresario, and he had just discovered this band. And he says, well, they need a road manager and they need a sound engineer. And I said, well, I'm an engineer. Okay. And that's what it is. That's why I had to learn quickly.
Did you know Sid Bernstein came out with a record in his 90s of him playing, I think it's the piano or something, before he died?
No. Yeah. I have no idea.
Yeah, it's neat. Very random. But I had on, what's his name?
Sid Bernstein.
No, I didn't have him on. He's dead. No, I had on.
Just a shot in the dark. There you go. Was that funny?
I don't know. I guess it doesn't matter. They're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I just can't think of his name.
Well, I know it isn't Dolly Parton now that you mentioned that, you know, because she's not going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, the thing with that, I mean, everybody's praising her for saying, you know, it's too good for me. But what I figure is it should be where it's like maybe the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame needs to take note that they need to focus on what it is they're trying to do.
Yeah.
She's not all a over the rock and roll singer. Of course. So, I mean, it was a very polite way of saying, wrong person. I don't do that.
Yeah. So, but now she's going to put out a rock and roll album, I understand.
She said she would. I mean, we'd all listen. I mean, I don't know. It would be so cool. Can you imagine she brings in a bunch of buddies and does all these? It would be so much fun. That'd be good. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, she'd probably sing on Doja Cat's album.
The what?
She'll sing on the new Doja Cat album.
It'd be hilarious. It'd be great. So you guys first met then you were on the road together when you guys first met, or you were at A1 when you guys first met?
Oh, the Mandrill had moved to California.
Right.
And I lucked into this wonderful old 1920s home in Hollywood. And because of a mutual friend of ours. And so Jan was in the house. And I said, oh, hello. What are you doing? We got to meet each other and just hit it off right away. That was 75.
Yeah. Oh, sure. It's a little more involved. David was dating this woman at the time, and he left stuff in the garage. So he sent Michael and I over to the house to go get his stuff. But when we got there, the house was vacant, and we ended up making a deal with the landlord, because it was in those days it was a lot simpler. And we moved into the chateau on the top of the Hollywood Hills. Woo-hoo. And that's when I met David, and we became best friends almost instantaneously.
So how long did you live in LA, Jan?
Oh, 30 years. Lived in LA for 30 years.
Oh, really long. And then from there is where you went to Thailand?
No, I went to Thailand. Well, I'm still living in Las Vegas. I still have a presence in Las Vegas. Oh. That's where the headquarters of Sound Broker is. But due to, you know, I was one of the, let's say, early adapters to figure out how to work from anywhere in the world. And so I was, when I was living in Los Angeles, I was spending a lot of time in Brazil, because what Sound Broker does, basically, I don't have to really go on site anymore. Very rarely would I ever go on site. And so as long as I could communicate with computer and cell phone or telephone, I'm able to control whatever I need to control from anywhere in the world. And right now, yeah, I am in a little place called Rawai, Phuket, which is an island in Thailand.
And you've been there for how long?
Since July. I was planning on coming back sooner, but due to unmitigated circumstances, finding someone that I fell in love with has changed my plans. And then of course, COVID is a nightmare for traveling. It's just been a bear to go anywhere. It's very, very difficult. As everybody knows.
What are your favorite Thai bands?
I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't have my favorite. I guess my favorite band, of course, would have to be the Beatles. But I'm being burnt out on the Beatles. It's just they just play that music all the time, everywhere in the world. It's crazy how much Beatle music there is out there. Yeah. And you know, and so yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen the movie Get Back, I recommend it. The 6 hours is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I liked it. All right, I'm going to pick one of these guys here. I got to know about Zeppelin, of course. But before we go into Zeppelin, I'm going to ask you about... Tell me about Doc Severinsen.
Who, me?
Yeah, that's a fun one. I haven't heard anybody bring up Doc Severinsen. That's a cool
Doc one. Severinsen was a prodigy. He was one of those guys at 6 years old was in front of orchestras, you know, that kind of, playing the trumpet. And... he never stops playing the trumpet. When you're standing with him, he's either got a mouthpiece with no trumpet on, going, you know, or he's doing it without anything in his lips. He never stops playing. And he, at the time, he had like 5 gigs. He had the Las Vegas show. He had the Tonight Show. He had the Doc Severinsen orchestra that when they went out and did, because he was like the guest conductor in symphonies. And he had a jazz group, a fusion jazz group, 5 guys. And that's what I did with him, is I went out with the jazz group. So the Tonight Show was only, Johnny Carson only had Monday to Thursday to work. He was off Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So on Thursday nights, we would head out to the airport, and Doc, every weekend, would work in 2 different places as this jazz group. Those were the days when, as a roadie, you could put all the band gear on a plane. Just pay the sky cap, $100, $200, and your Ampeg 360 bass amp, all that, just went on the plane. So every place we went, we had our own band gear and a couple of monitors and a rack and stuff, and we just worked all the time. And his fusion music was great.
I bet.
Yeah. I did the orchestra a couple of times too, so I heard all of that kind of music with him.
Doc was pretty amazing, you know, a virtuoso for sure. And one day, Doc calls David into a room and says, David, he says, I wish I could play as constantly as good as you mix my sound. I think that's the way he said
that's
it.
That's a compliment for sure.
I forgot that.
What about Jim Neighbors? Was he doing stand-up, or what did you do?
Jim Neighbors is one of the funniest people, was one of the funniest people in the business. And also one of the nicest people in the business. Plus, he had that baritone, that amazing baritone voice. So his shows were fabulous. I loved working with Jim Neighbors. It was just a trio on stage, a few backing tracks with vocals and stuff, but all him. And it was great to work with him.
Super neat. That one's good. I like some of the random ones, those are the ones that are fun. Like, did you ever think you'd be working for Jim Neighbors? And be like, no, it wouldn't have come to the front of my list, but it was frigging great. Yeah.
Well, you know, what's funny is there are certain people are very funny people. They think funny. They talk funny. They're just funny. And I've been lucky enough to work with some amazingly funny people where there's laughs going on all the time.
Yeah.
She's one of them. Debbie Reynolds was another one. Oh, she awesome. Loved to laugh. I spent 40 years with Debbie Reynolds laughing. Having a great time. I mean, I was really lucky in a lot of ways. You know, I'm not the rock and roll touring guy. I did that earlier in my career, and then I discovered the Vegas acts. Go for 1 week at a time instead of one night at a time. Yeah. So instead of doing one-nighters, I'm doing one-weekers. I get to unpack and use the drawers and have hobbies on the road and work for one star surrounded by 30 musicians who read music. With great arrangements and great songs. So that's the bulk of my career. That's why most of those names you mentioned were star headliners.
Did you know Milt Suchin?
No, who's that?
So he was Debbie Reynolds' manager for a while, but he managed Phyllis Diller. And so I became friends with him because I was good friends with Phyllis Diller. But he's a neat guy. And he managed Debbie Reynolds for a little bit. That's why. But
yeah. Yeah, well, Debbie wanted us to call her mother because she felt like we were a family. You know, she loved sitting around the dressing room after the show. And remember, these are casinos. So you just pick up the phone and you order whatever you want. It's all free. Oh. And we would sit there till 6, 7 in the morning Every night after the shows, just hanging out.
Did you order flight attendants?
No, just a lot of shrimp cocktails.
Understood. Yeah. Understood.
Debbie Reynolds was a wonderful woman. David one day says to me, hey, look, our production manager, Debbie did a show called The Thalian Ball. And basically, it was a charity for a wing of the hospital that donated to actors that didn't have money. That was what it was. So if you got sick, you went into the at Cedars-Sinai Hospital.
Okay.
And so David says, are you interested? I was doing production management. And David says, I got this gig for you if you're interested. Debbie wants to interview me. So I said, sure. And we go up to our house and we're sitting there. And it's just, I mean, she's so sweet and so nice. And she starts talking about her daughter who is having a problem with a boyfriend. And I said, I'm single. So I happen to say, well, I'm available. And she looks at me and she says, my daughter would eat you up and spit you out. There's not a chance I'm going to introduce you to my daughter. And David, now we're driving home, and David says, how could you say something so stupid? I said, what do you mean? She says, her daughter is Carrie Fisher. You know, the boyfriend that they just broke up with was Paul Simon.
That's awesome.
I did not know that.
She would have chewed you up and spit you out.
Princess Leia, you know?
That would have been fun. That would have been fun. So when I first started putting together this podcast, I was at my buddy's house. My friends all have little kids at this point. And his daughter, who's in fifth grade, came up with a question with a couple of her little friends. And the question was, when did you first feel famous? So I ask each of you guys, when did you first feel famous? Now, if fame is not a road that you choose to pursue for whatever reason in answering the question, when did you first feel good about yourself? When was there a moment in your career that's worth mentioning that was a catalyst to something else? Or what comes to mind of an event that you guys would pick out of the hat?
So many. Oh my God. I mean, you mentioned Barbara Streisand.
Oh,
nobody
yeah.
mixes Barbara Streisand. The only, it was Bruce Jackson for all those years before he passed in that plane crash. And then she didn't work for decades. And then she finally works again. I worked with her on these one-off gigs that she did that they vetted me. I was working with Bette Midler. And it was a Democratic fundraiser for president. And so Bette was doing it, and Barbara was the headliner. And her people listened to me mixing Bette, and they said, you want to mix Barbara? I went, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So I mixed her for that event. Then I mixed her at another fundraiser at Marvin Davis's house. If you know, he used to own 20th Century Fox.
Okay.
Marvin Davis's house. And then I ended up mixing the sound at her wedding. So I've only mixed it three times, but I'm still in a very small fraternity of people who's ever mixed Barbara Streisand.
It is neat. I love Barbara Streisand. Good stuff. She's mental, man. How could you not like Barbara Streisand?
I didn't have to do a thing. I didn't have to do a thing to her mic. She was perfect. I didn't have to worry about compression. I didn't have to worry about EQ. I didn't have to worry about volume, spacing, dynamics. It was all like organic.
How long were you with Bette Midler?
Two different times. First time I was a stage manager. For a tour for the summer, and then I did a few one-off gigs where I actually got to mix her show. So
another one. Oh, so
she also, I used to see her all the time. I mean, when Barry Manilow was her piano musical director, and Melissa Manchester was one of the Harlettes, was the first time I saw her. Mark Shaman was her keyboard player, the one who went on to write Hairspray and all these other musicals and win Tony Awards by the gazillions. He was her musical director at the time.
That's neat. All right, Jam, what do you got?
I have a two-prong answer. So first, I'm going to do a visual here.
Okay.
And that is a picture of me and Gilbert Gottfried.
Oh,
and the reason
great.
I show you that picture is now I'm actually much taller than Gilbert Gottfried, and I'm standing there. This is backstage at the Universal Amphitheater. It was before it became the Gibson Amphitheater before they destroyed it. But that's Gilbert and myself. And basically, so what happened was that I was performing at the Comedy Store. I was a regular at the Laugh Factory. And so one night after the show, I went over to this restaurant called Ships.
Okay.
And I walked into the restaurant. There was a line out the door, And this guy comes up to me. He says, he's like on the line. He says, "Oh, you are so funny. I think you are hilarious." I said, "Well, thank you very much. I saw your show the other night. You broke me up, man. I'll tell you." I said, "Well, that," he said, "look, you want to come in and sit down?" I said, "Yeah." And he gets these people to stand up and give me the table. It turns out he thought I was Gilbert Gottfried. So that was I guess the
put it back up, Jim. Put it back up so that like, people see you and Gilbert together.
Oh, all right, I'll put it back up. There it is, me and Gilbert.
It's pretty funny. That's a good one.
You know. I guess the other thing what I would have to say is, you know, I've done so many things in my life that most people could only dream about doing. You know, my going out on the road with Led Zeppelin, and the way it came about to do the Pontiac, Michigan show, which was my very first tour ever to go out on the road, and actually sitting down with Robert Plant and the crew and getting to know them, that was a cool story. Another great story that I have is meeting Bon Jovi. And one of my very best friends in life, Peter Scher, who's passed, unfortunately, he was his travel agent. And I get a call from Peter and says, "Hey, look," and I had met John multiple times. And so Peter says, "John's coming into town and he needs to be picked up at the airport, brought over to some building in Beverly Hills. He's gonna be in disguise. I want you to pick him up in your car, bring him over there, wait for him, and then take him back to the airport." So I did that, and John and I had a good time. We were talking and we got to know each other a little bit. Now, flash forward a couple of years later, I am backstage at the Universal Amphitheater to see Keith Richards when he was doing a solo tour. And all of a sudden, behind me, somebody comes up and goes like this. And I hate that. I hate when somebody, and I pull the arms around, and there is Bon Jovi. There's John. And he, "Hey, man, what's doing on?" Blah, blah, blah. We started talking. He says, "You know Richie?" I said, "Of course, yeah, hey, Richie, what's going on?" He says, "You seeing where you're going to sit the show?" I said, "I got some seats." He said, "Nah, come with me." And we went upstairs into the Universal Amphitheater, and in the light, basically right by the spotlight, there was a storage locker room where they put the cases, the road cases. And we sat there in this room, and I sat on their road case while they were standing looking outside. And then they sat down next to me, John on one side, Richie, and they started singing harmony to Keith Richards. And it blew my mind. It blew my mind. It's an experience that I will remember forever. That's that. At that point in time, I didn't think I was famous, but I knew I was someplace else. Another story, thanks to Debbie Reynolds, is going back to the Thalian Ball, and this is probably one of the highlights of my life, is that every year they had somebody who they called Mr. or Mrs. Wonderful. And I met Angela Lansbury, and I met Lucille Ball, and I met Robert Blake, and Dennis O'Connor. I mean, what a man that guy was. He became a friend of mine, you know. But one day, the Mr. Wonderful was Jimmy Stewart. And I just released the crew. I had just released the crew for dinner, getting ready to change into my tuxedo, when I get a call on the radio that there's somebody at the kitchen loading dock looking for me. So I go down there, and there he is, bigger than life, Jimmy Stewart.
Wow.
And I say, "Mr. Stewart, what are you doing here? You know, we were supposed to send the car." He said, "Well, I live right down the street. I didn't really feel like waiting, you know." So I said, "So I drove over here myself. You know, I don't need a car." I said, "Wow, that's amazing." And then he turns to me, and I was so, I mean, I'm a professional, but at this point in time, I'm losing my cool. And I'm talking to him, and he turns to me and says, "Do you think there's a place we can go rather than standing on the kitchen loading dock?" I said, yeah, "Let me take you to your dressing room." So I take him to his dressing room, and I show him around the dressing room. Is if you have anything you need, let me know. And I'm walking out because I'm going to give him, now I'm gaining my composure, I'm going to give him his privacy. And he turns to me as I'm walking out. He says, "Do you have to leave?" And I said, "No." He says, "Sit, let's talk." And I spoke with Jimmy Stewart for 45 minutes. And that, I will never forget that guy, I swear to God, that guy did not know how famous he was. Just not a chance, not a clue in the world. He was as down to earth as any person I'd ever met in my life. But the stories that he had were amazing. And I said to him at one point, I said, you know, you're in my most favorite movie of all times. And he looks at me and smiles and says, Harvey? And I said, no, It's a Wonderful Life. He says, I knew that. He says, you know, I didn't want to do that movie. I turned it down three times, but they made me do it. And it turns out that originally Humphrey Bogart was cast in that part. Yeah, that's what he told me. He says Humphrey Bogart was cast in that part, but he had a stroke during the African Queen. Okay. And so they needed somebody else. And he did. He had heard that it was really rough to work with, what was her name? I got mental block on the actor, the actress who played.
I can cheat. Is it Lombard? No.
No. Oh God, I can't remember. I can't believe I got mental block. When you say the name, I'll remember. Anyway, Donna.
Donna Reed, right?
That
was It's a Wonderful Life. Was she and Harvey?
Yeah. And he'd heard the reason why I didn't want to do it is because he heard it was hard to work with her. But he told me that was just a lot of nonsense. She was wonderful to work with. So anyway, that's one of my highlights of my stories. And one other thing I'll share with everybody, because this is really cool. One of the things that I ended up doing was I ended up being the technical director and sold a TV show to ABC called The Comedy Club Superstars. And the Comedy Club Superstars was a guy by the name of John DeBellis had this idea because he'd played with all these famous guys like Jerry Seinfeld, Paul Reiser, Tim Allen. Well, and he had the idea that what happened to the comedy club stars of the 80s, how they affected watching TV in the 90s. And all of these shows were the top shows. And what we did was we went to all of these different celebrities, Lily Tomlin, Paula Poundstone, of course, Jerry Seinfeld, Tim Allen, Paul Reiser, Richard Lewis. I mean, about 50 stars. If you look it up, Comedy Club Superstars, you might be able to see it. It was the lowest rated show on ABC on a Saturday night in the history of ABC, just an FYI. But the things that I learned from that, and I learned something, and I'm going to share this with everybody because there were four things that they all said. Everyone said the same thing, is that number one, to be famous, that you had to believe in yourself. And so no matter if you want to get in this industry, or you want to be a teacher, or you want to, whatever it is you want to be, you got to believe in yourself. To be the best you can be, you got to believe in yourself. That's number one. Especially if you want to be a performer or whatever it is, you got to believe in yourself. Number two is that you can only be with people that believe in you as much as you believe in yourself. That's a little more difficult to do, but that's something that, you know, it's important. Number three is that you got to do something about what your profession is every day. So if it's comedy, you got to be writing jokes, you got to be getting out performing, you got to do whatever you want. And the last thing that they all said, every one of them said, that you can't have a safety net. And that changed my whole life when I found that out, that I decided to give up my production work and become a stand-up comedian. And it wasn't for 2 years where all of a sudden I had money in the bank, I had a nice life, all of a sudden I'm penniless, I'm refinancing my car so I have enough money to pay my rent, but I believed in myself. And then I got a call from a guy by the name of Morris Leiter. And you mentioned Charlie Hernandez, you must know Morris Leiter, you know, from Genesis, Phil Collins. Morris gave me probably more jobs than anybody else, Prince, Elton John. I mean, I worked with a lot of people, and it was all thanks to Morris. And Morris needed my help to sell some equipment. And I remember calling Morris, calling me up and says, I need your help. I need you to sell some of this stuff so I can buy new stuff. And I said to Morris, I said, Morris, I can't do that anymore because I'm a comedian. And without losing a beat, Morris said to me, that's the funniest thing you've ever said. And the rest is history, because I ended up doing it. And from the Disney Fest, then we picked up JBL and the discontinued sale of JBL. And then for the rest of my life, I've done Soundbroker for the last 25 years. And I've had a phenomenal career.
Yeah.
How neat is that? So how many, to jump back a bit, but the Zeppelin thing, how many shows did you do with Zeppelin?
One before I was, let me show you this if I can. This was the setup, and it's an interesting story, and David can come in on this. What I did was the video projection. Now, in those days, they didn't have video projection like they do today. When Led Zeppelin was touring. So they were playing, this was the Pontiac Arena. They had 73,000 people, and they had the idea that they wanted to show people in the back row what they looked like. And so that's what they did. You know, they basically, oh, I think I'm frozen. All right, let me see what we can do to unfreeze myself. I hate to do it like this, but I'm going to just switch over to, you're going to see what I really look like now, because I'm going to take off the blue screen, green screen, you know. But the reality is that, so they wanted people to see, and I was working for a company called World Stage at the Sunset Lot. Now, David will fill you in on the Sunset Lot, and then I'll take the story back over. So tell them about the Sunset Lot, David.
All right. Columbia Movies had their studio in Hollywood, and it's right basically Sunset and Beechwood Gower area. And production got to be too expensive, and so they started doing a lot of location stuff, and they merged with Burbank Studios, Warner Brothers, and emptied out the Columbia lot. And a few, and so one of the big sound stages became a tennis court, two tennis courts, and the rest of the sound stages sat empty. And they were doing nothing. And some very entrepreneurial guys, starting with two sound guys who used to work for Tycho Brahe, started renting a soundstage. And slowly but surely, A1 Audio was in there, Morpheus Lighting was in there, Olsen Lighting was in there, Fleetwood Mac's management was in there, and World Stage took over two stages. And it became Rock and Roll Disneyland, which deserves a documentary, and nobody has done it, and I keep trying to sell it to somebody because it was an amazing time. They invented pre-tour production shows. That's where the first time anybody was able to set up full sound and lights before they went on the road and didn't have to have stuff shipped to Cleveland because they had never set up the show before. So it was a huge deal. And World Stage had two of these stages, one for the performance area and one for the projection of what's in the performance area. And in between them was a satellite truck. So the signal went up to the satellite, down, and they projected it in the next room. And this was earth-shaking. This is what Elvis used in Elvis from Hawaii. I mean, this was a big deal. And Jan was their sales manager.
Okay.
And I was working with Maryland Sound, who took over one of the sound stages. And I got to meet all these people, and that's when Al and I first got to know each other with A1 Audio. And just to take it a little further, SIR, which had a few places around town, built their flagship studio there, because that's where all the rehearsals were. So the place was unbelievable. I mean, you just see people, David Bowie, they're all walking around like, because nobody else was there. It was our own place, and it was incredible.
Yeah, it is.
All right, so now here's Jan Landy, and with this high tech, I mean, a satellite truck sitting right outside the soundstage.
And the concept of World Stage, which is way ahead of its time, was we would beam up a show that was taking place in one location through the satellite, and it come down, and we would show it on this IDA4 projector screen. The screen was four IDA4 projectors, and these projectors were as big as Volkswagen vans. Yeah, that's how big they were.
$250 million each.
Yeah, and the idea was we would show it on 120 feet wide and 80 feet high. So it was bigger than life, but it was two-way video. So that the concept is that they wanted to do a show in one location, beam it all over the world to different stadiums. And like, for example, the Rolling Stones could be out there and says, "Hey, Los Angeles," and Los Angeles would go crazy, and they'd be looking at their screens and they would see what's happening in Los Angeles. Or, "Hey, New York City," and then they'd look at the screens and they would be able to interact with their audiences.
Got it.
And, but it didn't go over. And I learned something very valuable from a guy by the name of Buckminster Fuller. I got to meet some very interesting people while doing World Stage. One of the people was Buckminster Fuller, who is won the Nobel Prize for Physics.
Yeah.
He built the geodesic domes. You've seen them everywhere, right? And what he said to me was, is that this will not work, because the more high tech we get as a society, the more high touch we need as people. And there's no high touch in this concept. And so basically that's that. And Bill Graham said to me, and Bill Graham, I love Bill Graham. And I got to meet Bill Graham before I actually got in the business, because I went to see Watkins Glen. I went to Watkins Glen that had the band, the Allman Brothers, and the Grateful Dead. It was a great show. It was amazing. And I got this, I ended up getting to meet Bill Graham because I saved somebody's life, and he brought me backstage, and he was a wonderful human being. And I don't know if I'm afraid to show it, so I'm not going to show it, but I still have the t-shirt that he gave me, friends of the bands. Anyway, and Bill Graham said to me, look, the reason why I don't like it is because you can't feel their sweat. And I said, you can't feel their sweat if they're in the second row, you know, but he wasn't going to go for it. So anyway, Led Zeppelin had heard about this. I had, you know, because I tried to get them to be one of the bands. And they said, you know what? We don't want to do the beaming, but we want to use the screen. That's a great idea. Let's just shoot the stage show, and we'll put the screen up behind the stage. And that's how I ended up going out to Pontiac, Michigan with Led Zeppelin. It turns out that I ended up getting involved. Like I said, I ended up hanging out with Roger Plant and the crew. They were fascinated that I was an American. I was the only American on this on this road. But then Peter Grant got involved. He threw me off the tour right then and there. And there's a big story to that, but that part of the story is confidential for right now. But I wasn't on the show until Peter Grant kicked me off the show and didn't pay the bill. So that's the story of my Led Zeppelin story, but it's pretty amazing.
Do you have any other gigs that come to mind, either one of you, that are just odd gigs, you know, places that you walked into and it's sort of like, well, this is unusual, you know, something that stood out or stands
out? Yes. I worked for Prince for 2 years, and every day felt that way. Every day. Every day felt that way.
Were you with Prince?
1993 to 1995, I think, something like that. He had this club called Glam Slam, and working with A1 Audio, I became the production manager there. We built the room, and basically he hired me as his production manager. The interesting thing is that even though I was there for 2 years, never once did I ever speak to him. I was as close to him as sitting next to him. And I remember one time I was sitting in the booth, and he comes in with him, one other person, and his bodyguard. He always had these huge bodyguards with him. And he sits down right next to me. And he's so close to me, I have to scoot over a little bit, you know? So I scoot over, and then he goes to the bodyguard. He calls the bodyguard over, and he goes, and the bodyguard says, okay, and walks around and comes to me and says, the boss would like you to sit over there.
That's great.
You know, that's kind of funny, you know?
All right,
What do you have, David?
Well, there's so many. I mean, you know, having worked with so many acts and done everything from showrooms to arenas to stadiums to 4th of July celebrations underneath the arch in St. Louis. I mean, I had great stuff. But the first band I was with was called Mandrill, which deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They were one of the first bands of world music. There was no way to pigeonhole what they did. But in any case, they did jazz as well. And so we got invited to a jazz festival in Tangier, Morocco. And
that's neat.
It was we were in a bullring in Morocco, and you're in there, and in the dressing rooms there are guys lighting a lot of the local musicians as well as people who were imported in. And the local musicians, you know, they're playing their local instruments. So they had drums that they had to heat the skin heads on. So they started a fire in the dressing room. It's concrete. They didn't care. And they're warming their drums up over the fire to go out and play. And so that whole thing was so interesting. And then, as it turns out, it started to rain on the last night. So they moved us into a theater, and they carried in like 25 like Persian rugs to cover the stage and everything. And it turns out Mandrill's equipment never made it from New York to Morocco, but it was a jazz festival. So there was they found vibes, they found the B3 organ, they found a gong, they found the saxophones and the congas. They found everything but a trombone. That was the one instrument they couldn't find. And we did the show there. And you just don't forget.
Oh, that's neat.
Working in Tangier. That's pretty cool. Good. One of many, many wonderful experiences I had on the road.
What is what's Sound Broker?
I have another interest.
Oh, what do you got? Okay.
Before we do that, I want to share something with you, an unusual story. So I was at one point in my career, I was the performing arts director for the City of Los Angeles Street Scene Festival. I don't know if you remember that. It was in the early 80s. And basically, you know, millions of people would come downtown. We had 14 stages. I booked 10,000 artists, including the LA Philharmonic. And one of the things that I booked was the Los Angeles cheerleaders. And you could see in this picture, they're in a dumpster. this is a trash dumpster that I got them all into, and I'm driving. If you can see that, let me see if I can make that bigger. Yeah, I don't know if I can make that bigger. That's something. And David, of course, you can see there I am. And then there is there it is. Let me make this. Let me move it over here. There you go. There I am. And you can see the cheerleaders there in the dumpster and the dump truck. So let me go. Let me clear that. The other thing is,
what did your hat say? Was that a Make America Great hat?
No, it said the Los Angeles Street Scene Festival.
Oh, did it? All right.
Yeah. And here's another thing that stands out in my mind. I don't know if you could see this. Let me see if I can make this big as well. This is the House of Blues. And on the stage right there, that's Crosby, Stills, Nash.
Oh.
And the House of Blues was an amazing place on Sunset Boulevard.
Sure.
It was the second House of Blues. The first one was in Louisiana and New Orleans, and the second one they built in Los Angeles. Now, David and I worked on this project together. And David and Kenny Newman had to figure out how to, now normally sound systems are not very complicated once you get the room layout, but in this particular venue, they had a wall that opened up, completely opened up. So if you were sitting in the restaurant side on the bar, it looked like you were in just a normal club until the wall opened up, and then you could see the stage and all the people in the showroom. And so we had to figure out a way how to change the sound, because the whole room would change when the wall opened up.
Got it.
Right? And the wall was in the way of the speaker, so we had to have different speakers, right? And they ran out of money just before they decided to go with the sound system. And I had to really work hard, and we got Yamaha to, and of course, Yamaha is not a brand name to be known for speakers. As a matter of fact, they had to buy Nexo to get some speaker recognition. But in those days, they had come out with a new speaker called the Waveguide speaker, which was a super inefficient speaker, but they were the only ones that were going to give us any money. So we used this for the club, and we tuned the room really fine. The first act, Aerosmith.
Oh.
And there was only 800 people that could fit into that club. But the night Aerosmith paid, there probably was maybe, you know, 900, maybe 1,000. I mean, I'd gotten calls from all over the world. Could you please get me in? Could you please get me in? So an unusual story was the show went off. It was phenomenal. It was an amazing night. And I thought everything was perfect. And all of a sudden on the walkie-talkie, someone says, Landy, They want you up in the dressing room. Steven Tyler wants to speak to you. Now, if you've ever done any shows, you know that the artist never demands to see you if he's happy. Yeah. And I'm thinking, oh my God, my career is over. My career is over. And I walked into the room, and there was Steven Tyler. He comes running over and he gives me a big hug and says, I can't believe what you did with the Yamaha rig. This is beautiful. It sounds phenomenal. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Cool.
We were so nervous. I had been involved with the installation of the sound, and I was there, and typical for an opening night, everything was late. The rehearsal, what rehearsal? We're still building the stage. So we didn't have a decent sound check, and we got Aerosmith, and I'm ready to have every speaker blown out in the first song. I'm really nervous during the whole show. And as it turns out, nothing blew up. And then Jan got his accolades, which was really great.
Really great.
It was nervous.
Now here is a very interesting part of that story. We recorded that with 5-camera video. And I actually have the first 4 songs on video, and they didn't do anything. They what they did was blues numbers, and I actually have it, and I think me and the guy that videotaped it is the only person in the world that has ever seen that, including the band. And I would love to show that to people. It is so brilliant. It is so great. The sound is good on it, but I'm afraid that if I put it up on my YouTube channel or I put it up on my Facebook page, that it'll get flagged.
Hit up the management. Sell it to Aerosmith management. You can make some money out of them.
Now they got the original multiband 2-inch tapes, but I don't know whatever happened. They took those tapes, and I don't know whatever happened to it. Hmm. You know, but speaking of recordings and stuff, and an interesting story, that opening night, Saturday night, Dan Aykroyd was really cool. I mean, I really liked Danny. He was a great guy to me. Really, you know, I got to work very closely with him and his brother, Jim, and, it wasn't his brother, but Jim Belushi, not the comedian, unfortunately, but his brother. So the Saturday night, it was Isaac Hayes, the Blues Brothers, and they brought in Paul, what's Paul's name from David Letterman? Paul Schaefer. Paul Schaefer. John Goodman. It was an amazing band that they put, Duck Dunn, you know, and then James Brown.
Oh, yeah.
So you want a production story? Okay. So James Brown didn't show up for rehearsal. Duh, how unusual is that? So about 6 o'clock at night, I see some people walking down the stairs to the showroom, and it's, I don't know, 20 people, and James Brown's one of them. And he comes up to the stage, and he looks at the stage, and he points at the monitors on the stage. And he says, "What's that?" And I'm saying, how could he not know what that is? You know, and I said, "Those are stage monitors." He says, I know what they are. What are they doing there? And I said to him, well, they're there so people can hear themselves. So he says, I pay my musicians enough. They don't have to hear themselves. Get them off the stage. But I couldn't do that because I had Isaac Hayes and I had Dan Aykroyd, and he didn't come up, you know. So anyway, so now, He goes up and he tries to finagle a Yamaha piano out of me. He says, I like that piano. Can I take that with me? I said, no, it's a rental. I can't give it to you. He says, well, maybe after the show I could take it. And I said, no, you can't take that piano. You can't take the piano. And the last thing he says to me before he leaves is, what time do I go on? And I said to him, you go on at 10 o'clock. He says, okay. And he walks away. So now the show is about to start. Everything's going perfect. It's right on time. I mean, this room is packed with every celebrity known to man. It's amazing how many celebrities are in this room for this. It's Magic Johnson putting on a special for the kids, and Dan Aykroyd invited every one of his friends, and it was for Steven Spielberg, because he wanted Steven Spielberg to see the opening of the bar. It was very exciting, right? Very, very
Was
exciting.
David there? David, were you there?
I believe David was there.
I might have been there.
Good.
Anyway.
Making sure.
So the show is about to start. But he doesn't, Dan Aykroyd says, we have to hold the show back. I said, why? He says, because Steven Spielberg is stuck in traffic on the other side of town. Okay.
Welcome to LA.
So we now hold the show back, and I'm ready to put Isaac Hayes on. Isaac says ready to go. And then Steven shows up at the club and we start the show, and Isaac Hayes goes on and plays. It's an amazing set. He does great set. Everybody's going crazy. And then Dan Aykroyd's band goes on, the Blues Brothers. And so now he's getting ready to walk on the stage, and he says to me, where are my harmonicas? I said, what do you mean, where are your harmonicas? He says, where's my harmonica belt? I said, I never saw that. He says, and he turns to his assistant. He says, where's my harmonica belt? And because he has the belt, that's the whole idea of the Blues Brothers. You know, he pulls the harmonica out of like a bullet vest. And the guy says, I put it on your bed. And he says, I didn't take it. So now he won't go on stage until somebody drives back all the way across town in traffic in LA to get the belt. They finally come. I got a million things on my mind, a million things. And now the Blues Brothers are on, the place is going wild. It's crazy. And I get a call on the radio that James Brown wants to see me. I said, okay, go up. And James Brown, I walk into the dressing room, open the dressing room, and there James Brown is wearing this skin-tight red outfit that he basically can't sit down in. If he sit down, it would split it up wide open. And he's got these two huge mountain guys next to him. Now, a little aside, James Brown gets paid in cash whenever he played, and he always gets paid in advance. And so I walk into the room and I said, yeah, what's up? And he says to me, what time do I go on? And I said, you go on at 10 o'clock. And he says to me, what time do I go on? And I'm thinking, what the same story that happened down there below with the monitor system, what's he talking about? I said, you go on at 10 o'clock. He says, I'm gonna ask you one more time. What time do I go on? And I look at my watch and it's 10:15.
Oh, okay.
Because of all the delays, I didn't realize the time. And he says to me, he says, if I don't go on in the next 10 minutes, I'm leaving. And so I run down, I don't know what to do, my head's exploding. I run downstairs and I go to, and James Brown's just been a pain in the ass all this time. So I go down there, Danny's on the stage, I call him over, he comes over and I say, this is what happened. What should I do? And Dan Aykroyd says, tell him to go fuck himself. I can't wait to do this, because you know Aykroyd could keep playing. And then all of a sudden, nah. He says, go get Magic Johnson, and get Magic Johnson put together and a bunch of guys to go up there and talk to him. And sure enough, they went up and talked to him and they calmed him down. Wesley Snipes was there. I mean, it was just a million people, million celebrities. So now James Brown is on the stage and it's going crazy. And I'm standing on the edge of the stage and he calls me over and he says to me, who's in the audience? I said, a million people. He says, give me a name. I said, Bruce Springsteen. He says, Bruce Springsteen, come on up. I said, who else? I said, Woody Harrelson. Woody Harrelson, come on up. Dan Aykroyd. And now he's got all these people up on the room and he says, come on, get up on the stage. And I'm up on the stage and I'm doing the can-can with Bruce Springsteen on one side and Woody Harrelson on the other. And I'm having the time of my life, right? And I know I got this on, I know I'm shooting with five cameras. This is gonna be a memento that I'm gonna have for the rest of my life. The show ends, I rush to the truck. By the time I got to the truck, James Brown Gorillaz had already got to the truck and taken all the videotape.
Oh. So who knows what happened to it?
Nobody knows. I've tried to get that tape my whole life. I mean, there's video of me doing the can-can with Bruce Springsteen and Woody Harrelson, and I can't get it.
It's pretty cool. Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder if it exists, or I wonder if they just destroyed it.
I tried. I mean, you know, but, you know, I'm sure it's somewhere in the archives of James Brown, you know, and
where was he living when he died? He was, where was he?
He was in the Midwest, wasn't he?
I'm sure he didn't have the tapes with him. That's for sure.
Yeah, they had, there's a fun interview where he had been arrested. He was in trouble for whatever, you know. And as soon as they started asking me a question that was directly about what had happened, whatever it was, he just starts singing a song. And he keeps doing it throughout the interview. It's very good.
So yeah, he was a criminal through and through.
I have a James Brown story.
What do you got?
So Mandrill opens for James Brown at Madison Square Garden. And this is like 75, 74, because I work with them from 70 to 75. So I had never worked the Garden before. So this is pretty cool. You know, I lived in New York. We had worked the Philharmonic Hall. We worked Carnegie Hall. We worked the Schaefer Stadium in the park. We did, but we here now we're, and so, and it turns out because of the crowd being kind of unruly, especially back in the mid 70s, the house mix position was actually stage height on scaffolding walkway all the way into house left.
Okay.
So it wasn't in the middle of the, it was off to the side, but you could walk to it from the stage without having to go through the crowd. Okay. So I'm out there mixing and Mandrill's doing a show. And by the way, the walk-in music for every James Brown show was James Brown music. I've never heard anybody else only play their music because he didn't want anybody else to be, you know, better than him. So, by the way, Yoshiki also plays his own music. That's another guy who's so interesting that I work with now. Anyway, so they were doing the show, and Mandrill is killing. Mandrill had one of the best live shows. People to this day, when you go to YouTube and you go to a Mandrill tape from the 70s, people talk about Philly, the best show ever, you know. I mean, they sold out RFK Stadium in a festival, 85,000 people. So they're doing the show, and they go over there. For whatever reason, their 30-minute contract began 20 minutes before the show. They're not going to do that. They're going to do their 30 minutes at least. So they're playing, and the audience is going bananas, and James Brown is now getting really pissed off. So he sends his manager or his whoever out to me and says, turn him off. Turn him off. And I go, I'm not going to turn him off. So he takes his hands, and he brings all the faders down. So at that point, I couldn't do anything because they are the boss, right? So then he goes to the stage and he turns the monitors off on stage. Now the band is a percussion band and a horn band. So they're just going. They're playing the congas, the guitar player, the drummer's drumming. The audience is going nuts. The PA is totally off and it doesn't matter. Everybody's having a great time. And then they finally ended the show and we never work with James Brown again. That was that.
Yeah, everybody needs one good James Brown story for sure, you know?
Yeah. Well, guys, I really do appreciate your time. Thank you for it. You have your day ahead of you, Jen, because you're on the other side of the world here. So,
yeah. Yep.
I did do what you said now. When I go to the Thai restaurant, I say, was it no pet?
No pet. Yeah.
They look and like, okay, yeah, no problem. No pet. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. Which means not spicy.
Yeah, I can't do the spicy. So it was good. Yeah. So thank you for the tip.
Yeah, if you walk in Subadi, you go in there and say Subadi Mai. That means how you doing? Good to see you. You know, whatever Subadi Mai. And then they'll if they do speak Thai, they'll just reply Subadi. You know, it's pretty cool.
You're all good. I'll try that one next time. Okay.
I remember I was in a Thai restaurant once and I didn't really realize what those little marks were. And I said, "What's this for?" And he goes, "Not for Caucasian."
Yeah. Oh, because it's hot as hell. Yeah, yeah.
That was the oh, yeah. The spices here, you can definitely burn your mouth out for sure.
Not yeah, for
my okay. thing.
Well, listen, thank you for having us. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun to be with you. You know, I hope we showed you some party like a rock star, you know, aspects of our lives.
Indeed.
You know, and that was without talking about, you know, the sex and the drugs part of it.
I want to go do the can-can.
That's for another show.
That'll be the next show. All right. I'll talk to you guys both soon.
Oh, great. Bye, Joel.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrode.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rode. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.